I want to welcome everyone this evening to the community lecture series of the Old Tzedek Taylor Road Synagogue. Our opening lecture this evening, of course, is Rabbi Gifter. Our theme of the season is diversity and orthodoxy, and we had asked Rabbi Gifter to present to us his perspective of the of our community, the role of the yeshiva, the vital importance of the yeshiva in the decade ahead. So without further ado, I'd like to call upon Rabbi Gifter.
Good evening, my friends. When I was asked to speak tonight on the influence of the Telza Yeshiva upon the Jewish community, I wasn't aware of the fact that it was part of a discussion on diversity in Orthodox Judaism. You see, my friends, I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I'm a Torah Jew. Orthodoxy is strange to me. For years and years, I've been saying this over and over again, that this Greek term, orthodox, doesn't quite well describe what we Torah Jews believe in. And therefore, I will not be engaged in orthodoxy tonight, but rather in speaking a bit about Torah Jews. And it's true that Telza Yeshiva has done quite a bit for the Cleveland community. It's nearly 50 years, I think. Next year will be the 50th anniversary since we came to Cleveland. I didn't come here when the yeshiva came. I came 2 years later when I was asked by the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Bloch, Zichrono Livracha, and Rav Katz, Zichrono Livracha, to leave the rabbinate. I was in the rabbinate, and it was a lucrative rabbinate. And I was able to be a Torah Jew in the rabbinate, although my congregants were far from that. But they listened to everything I said as far as the community was concerned. As individuals, they were far from Torah Jews and very far from what you would call Orthodox Jews. But it was a wonderful kehillah in Waterbury, Connecticut. But when my uncles, Zichrono Livracha, the Rosh Yeshiva, asked me to leave the rabbinate and come to the yeshiva to help them in the work of building up the yeshiva here, I said, I'm going to do it. It means giving up a great deal as far as Parnosa is concerned and many other things, but it also means building toilet. And I didn't feel that in Waterbury I would be able to begin building toilet, even though we had begun the beginnings of a day school, the kindergarten. And that was continued by the wonderful colleague of mine who followed me there, who built a complete day school in Waterbury, Rabbi Gewirtz, Zolalang Lem. So I left Waterbury, I left the rabbinate, came here to Cleveland. Rabbi Bloch used to say, because many people asked him, was the Gefahr in Cleveland? He had no better place to establish a yeshiva way out in the Midwest in Cleveland. New York. So he said, New York, New York's packed with yeshivas. Every street corner has a yeshiva. In those days, every day school in New York was called yeshiva. Every day school was called yeshiva. So it's full of yeshivas. So I want to go to a place where the term yeshiva is completely strange and start working there. But Cleveland in those days was one of the world centers of Reform and Conservative Judaism. Rabbi Abihail Silver, world-renowned, the Reform rabbi, and Rabbi Barnett Brickner, the other Reform rabbi, very well-renowned throughout the world, and Park Synagogue, the conservative center. This was Cleveland. Orthodoxy, you can get an idea of what it was. The guest speaker at the Chibas Yerushalayim Shul, the biggest Orthodox congregation in those days in Cleveland, was either Barnett Brickner or Abihail Silver. Would you believe it? That was Cleveland. And we came here to build a yeshiva. People thought we were crazy. But today testifies to the fact that we did a good job and Tells here in Cleveland was one of the centers of the rebirth of Torah in the United States. Torah in its essence. Today we have many more yeshivas, not day schools, but yeshivas in this country. Thank the good Lord for that. But Tells has tried to maintain its tradition as one of the great yeshivas from overseas. Yeshiva there was one of five great Torah centers in Lithuanian Jewry. There were yeshivas in Hungarian Jewry and yeshivas in Polish Jewry. But in Lithuanian Jewry, there were five yeshivas. And one of those five yeshivas was Tells, established in 1885. It did a wonderful job overseas. But Hitler brought about the job that had to be done here in the United States. I doubt whether he had an idea of what his destruction of Jewry would lead to. And I keep telling the story that the Chaim Volozhiner, the first and great yeshiva of Lithuanian Polish Jewry, once burst out crying, "The last station for Torah before the coming of Mashiach will be the United States of America." And one of his great disciples asked him, "So why does the Rebbe cry? What's there to cry about?" His answer was, "I see how bitter it will be to create this last station." No one understood what he's talking about, what he was talking about. When Hitler came along, we began to understand what Reb Chaim Volozhiner had in mind. It's a station for Torah brought about by the destruction of European Torah, whether it be Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, Romania, completely destroyed. Lithuanian Jewry, in my day, existed with 93,000 Jews. There were left 3,000 Jews as a result of the war. Hungary had more left. Poland, many more left. Lithuania was practically completely, totally destroyed. This home of so much toil down through the years. And it had to be reestablished. It had to have a new station. The United States became that station. And Tells was the first European yeshiva that reestablished in the United States. It was followed by Lakewood, established by Rabban Kotler, Zichrono Livracha. But the first yeshiva of European origin was Tells, established in Cleveland. And from that day on, nearly now 50 years, the job of Tells has been continuing. What it has created, not merely for the community, but it has created Torah in South America, in Australia, many other countries, in South Africa, through the student body of the yeshiva. And they brought into these various stations from other yeshivas. The first yeshiva day school in South Africa, in Johannesburg, was established by a student of the yeshiva, Rab David Senders. I think that most of you know who he was and who he is. Was continued by another student who is still there, leading that school. Today there's a kollel in Johannesburg. These are unbelievable things. And so it is in Australia. So it is in many cities in the United States, where students of Tells went there for the domicile, to become inhabitants of the community. But you can't be a Tellzel in a community without Torah. So Torah was established in many, many communities throughout the country. How successful we have been in maintaining the tradition of Tells here at the yeshiva, I cannot say, because there's a vast difference between Tells 50 years ago and Tells today. There are a few of us left who saw Tells overseas. Very few. In other yeshivas throughout the country, there are none, the leaders of the yeshivas, who ever had the privilege of seeing Torah overseas. Here there are a few still in existence. I happen to be one of them. I had the privilege, only privilege, there's no other word for it, to study Torah overseas, to see what Torah study means without the comforts and luxuries of the United States. To come from the United States into a yeshiva where there were no inside bathrooms. You had to go outside in the cold weather of European winters. It's far from comfortable, I can assure you. The food that we had at home in the United States, we didn't have it there. My good friend Rabbi Paperman, he's a Baltimorean, and I'm a Baltimorean, originally a Virginian. I'm not a European. I'm a Native American, coming from the country of Jefferson, Madison, and Washington. I don't know how many Americans today know what that means. But in our day in this country, we did know about these things. Today, other subjects are taught. This Baltimorean didn't know me from Baltimore. He was from East Baltimore. And my parents had a little business in West Baltimore. Two worlds. It cost 10 cents for the streetcar fare, 5 cents to go from West Baltimore to East Baltimore, another 5 cents to return. That's 10 cents. Not all of us possessed 10 cents. So we didn't know each other from there. We got to know each other from pills overseas. What were the comforts? Rabbi Paperman in pills. He was a poor American. He couldn't afford a cup of coffee every morning. He drank chicory. Some of you, I guess, know what that means. Chihorie. What are you trunken? Huh? Not coffee. Oh, no. Huh? What? I don't know what you're saying. Chicorie, Zogirdo, Chicorie. In English, we call it chicory. A soft-boiled egg? Who ever heard of such a thing in tills in the morning? He didn't have it. He was a poor fellow. He couldn't afford to pay for that. It was black bread, some schmierichts, not butter. I don't remember what the schmierichts was. And chichorie, that was breakfast. That's the way we studied overseas. I'm not mentioning myself because I was a rich American. I could afford coffee, and I could afford a soft-boiled egg, and I could afford other comforts. And we studied Torah under such conditions. I wish you would have been able to see the joy of Torah study overseas. I'll tell you another little story. We used to go walking in the afternoon between the end of the first Seder after lunch and the beginning of the second of the afternoon session. It started at 4. So we used to take a walk, always in pairs, so we didn't waste time talking about nothing, but we used to discuss problems in Talmud studies. Would you believe that the Goyim, the Litvish Goyim, they were very uncultured. They used to beg us, come and walk in our fields. So we used to tell them, what do you mean, walk in your fields? We'll tread on the corn that grows there. No, walk in the fields. When we asked for the explanation, because we do not know why, but we know that in those fields where the Telzer Yeshiva Bochrim walk, the blessings of God rest there. And the fruits that grow forth are beyond belief. Goyim used to tell us that. Come and walk in our fields. That's what Torah study was overseas. From the early morning to the late hours of the night. But after 12, my father-in-law, who was the mashgiach of the yeshiva, used to come over to us and tell us, you must go to sleep, because if you won't sleep, you won't be able to study during the day. You must go to sleep. There was one youngster. He was the son of a rov in Lithuania who used to come in, and my father-in-law used to put the lights out. He was afraid they wouldn't listen to him. So he used to put the lights out. This youngster used to, and lock the door. This youngster, I can't forget him. When he saw that the yeshiva wasn't there, and my father-in-law, the mashgiach, had already left, so he used to crawl in through the window, and he found a way to put the lights back on again. And he used to study in the yeshiva b'smedrash till the early hours of morning. That's the way Torah was studied overseas. I can't begin to tell you what the ta'anug, the joy, the pleasure of Torah study meant to the entire student body and what it meant to the community as a whole. What it meant to the Lithuanian Jewry. Except naturally those who were totally strange to the elements of Torah study. Every community in Lithuania had Jews who were devoted to Torah. And their children were sent to these great centers, five centers in Lithuania, where Torah was studied, propagated, and through them handed on to various other communities. Hitler took care of all that. Very few remained. But those who did remain and carried with them this heritage, some of them came to the United States also, and they carried on that great heritage. That's the beginning of TELS in Cleveland, TELS in the United States. I'm one of the few left in this generation who had the privilege of Torah study overseas. At the age of 17, I was in TELS. I turned 17 on the ship traveling over the ocean to TELS. And there I was for a little bit over 5 years. Came back to visit wonderful parents, Aleihem HaSholem, who gave so much of themselves not to see a child in over 5 years. Here, when you come to study Torah in yeshivas, as in Lahavdil in the colleges, you're home every 2 months. Winter vacation, summer vacation, Bein Hazmanim, you're always home. Then over 5 years, parents didn't see the child. And I came back here with a thought in mind that I would return to that great center of Torah. But that thought was changed by Hitler. Because during the time of my visit home in Baltimore, Hitler went through the Axis with Mussolini. And I recognized that we're on the verge of a terrible, terrible destruction of Jews and Judaism. And I did not therefore return. And I had seen what was true. It was so. And therefore I am one of those numbered individuals who can still talk about Torah overseas, talk about it with memories of the joy that we enjoyed in Torah study without luxury. Torah itself is luxury. Torah itself is ta'anug. There can be no greater ta'anug in life than the study of Torah. And do you know why? Because in the study of Torah, we speak with the Almighty. We don't just speak with our friend, my study partner. We don't just speak with my Rebbe, who is my teacher. They are all conveyances to the Almighty. When I don't understand something, I'm speaking to Him, Ribbono Shel Olam, clarify it to me. If I'm worthy of it, He'll do it. If I'm unworthy of it, it remains an unanswered question. And there are many unanswered questions to me and to many others greater than me, the greats of all generations. Not always are we worthy that the Almighty should hearken to our prayer. Answer me, Ribbono Shel Olam. What does the Torah mean? Not always does He answer. These are things that we pray about in our daily prayers. We never stop to think of it. But overseas in the yeshiva, we felt it. That when we study Torah, we are engaged in a study of something with the Ribbono Shel Olam Himself. So how can one not be filled with joy and elation? Is there any other opportunity to be able to speak with the Almighty Himself? That's what yeshiva life means. That's what it means here in this country also. Boys studying yeshiva. American youngsters studying yeshiva. Their study means a discussion with the Ribbono Shel Olam to understand the intricacies of various laws by which we live. Whether it be the laws of damages, whether it be the laws of Yom Tov and Shabbos. When I once spoke in Cleveland Western Reserve University and explained to them our approach to Talmudic study, what to us is the meaning of the law of damages, Bava Kama, Bava Mitzia, they were astounded beyond words. To such an extent that, believe it or not, the head of the law school, he is no more. The head of the law school came over to me and asked me, would the rabbi condescend to come to us once a week and lecture on Talmudic studies? I told him I would be more than happy. But my duties at the yeshiva are such that I don't have the time for it. A weekly lecture, I don't have the time for it. But imagine a non-Jew, a professor of law, becomes overwhelmed hearing what Talmudic study signifies. So how can it possibly be possible that a Jewish student should study in a yeshiva and not be overcome with the joy of Talmudic study? What hurts me is that there are so few of us left who still remember what Torah was overseas and try to hand this down and implant it within their Talmidim. I have wonderful Talmidim at the yeshiva. Canadians, Americans, South Africans. Wonderful Talmidim. And I must tell you that they are also overwhelmed with what they hear from me about what Torah was. So overwhelmed that they studied Torah in depth here in the United States, from all these countries. That's what tells a yeshiva represents in this country. We have students from Eretz Yisrael also studying at the yeshiva. Students from various countries. Students from various states. From the Pacific to the Atlantic. Baruch Hashem, the Jews are interested in Torah study. What it means to a community is beyond words. You heard what this community was when we came here. Today, it's a world center of Torah living. Today, you have fine doctors, medical men, lawyers, professionals, studying Torah. Whether it be in the night kollel of the yeshiva, with its classes at the Hebrew Academy, whether it be in other night kollelim, as a result of the night kollel of the yeshiva, I think there are 5 or 6 today in the community, where Jews who knew little of Torah, a businessman, after a day of business from 8 to 10, engaged in Torah study. In various tractates. What such a thing means for the community at large is something that we cannot even imagine. It's a totally different scene where such life exists. It's life with a Ribbono Shel Olam. He's part of our living. We live together with him because that's Torah study. We have him in our homes. We have him in our places of business. That's Torah study. Now, what all this has to do with diversity is beyond me. I don't understand it. I have nothing of diversity to convey to you as far as the influence of Telza Yeshiva on the community of Cleveland and of many, many other communities. But I see that the title of the series is Diversity in Judaism or in Orthodoxy. But I've already pointed out to you that I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I'm a Torah Jew. So there is no place in Torah for diversity. Torah is a mapped path which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us at Sinai. Nothing is diverse in it. Yes, you can have diversity by stepping off that path. No question about it. Because every one of us has freedom of choice. Torah teaches us. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I am placing before you life and the good, death and the evil. Finished? No, it's not finished. The Ribbono Shel Olam went on with a piece of advice, not a commandment, a piece of advice. I advise you, choose life. I give you freedom of choice. You're not commanded to choose life, but I advise you, choose life. Because when you'll do that, you have life. But if you do not want to choose life, you'd rather choose es amores. Death, it's yours for your choosing. And you may say, what do you mean it's death? I live, and many of us live, till 70, 80 years of age, without observance of God's commandments in His Torah. But there's life. Ah, my friends, that you call life, that's life without joy. When I go down wintertime to my children, to our children in Florida for a little rest, so I always take a walk on Collins Avenue, the hotel street. There you find many rich Jews spending the winter there. And I see these rich Jews, men and women, walking down the street, Collins Avenue. And I become full of sympathy and full of pain. Empty-eyed. I see in them that they have no content in life. They're rich. They can afford a Florida vacation. They can even afford a better than Florida vacation. But what does it all amount to? Of what interest is that life? What do they gain from it? Walking down Collins Avenue, walking up Collins Avenue, empty-eyed, become tired, lay down and go to sleep. What do we achieve? That's life. That's living death. Torah living is gelebt. Und noch wie gelebt. Now let me tell you a little story. There was a little town in Lithuania called Kelum. That was a town where famous Jews lived, practiced Judaism, and taught Torah. One of those Jews was a man named Reb Simcha Zissel Ziv. Rabbi Dessler of our community is related to that great Jew. His students used to take note of the fact that many times he disappears from the Bais Medrash. Later he appears again. So they once asked him, "Wo wird der Rebbe Nelam? Where do you disappear?" So he said, "Why don't you understand? I sit and learn for an hour, for two, for three, and I'm bothered with a difficulty in understanding the Talmudic passage which I'm engaged in. And suddenly the good Lord is good to me, and my eyes open up, and I see it. So I become overwhelmed with simcha, and I want to go for a dance. So I go upstairs to the attic." "That's what you mean, I disappear. I go up to the attic, and in the attic, geich tanzen, geich atenzale. Out of sheer joy for having been zeiched to understand such a complicated gemara." Just listen to this. So his students asked him, "So why does the Rebbe have to go upstairs to the attic? Can the Rebbe get a pencil off a note?" So he said, "Don't you understand? If I would go dancing here in the Bais Medrash, so they'd all think, erich mishame mishuge geworden, as he mit mitvor geht er tanzen." I told this story to my student body once. A few days later, I delivered a shiur a lecture in Talmud. And in that lecture, I propounded a thought. And I said to them, Midachtzach, I think that we have hit upon depth that's worthy of joy. So one of the students, he's still with us, and you all know him, Rabbi Yisrael Schneider, Zalal Anglem, said to me, so Rebbe, why can't we go a tensel, even though we don't have an attic? And he didn't wait a minute, and the dance started. And I was with him. Getanzt und gesungen von Simchas Hatere. The Bochlim in the Besmedrash, because the shir is said in a special shir room. The other Bochlim who don't attend that shir heard dancing and singing. Haben sie gedacht, ich meinte, ich bin mir schuge geworden. Mitten Mittwoch. What kind of business is this? So they came to take a look. So Rabbi Saul Schneider took him into the dance. Und alle haben getanzt. That's the joy of Torah study. Can you have that where there is diversity in orthodoxy? Is that possible? Impossible. Because in Torah there is no diversity. It's a path mapped out by the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. Walk this path, and you'll reach Hachayim VeHatov. There can't be any diversity. Diversity starts where there is not that path, where people seek different paths in life. That's the diversity. You want joy? Torah. You want other things for joy. And so it is with all the concepts of life. They do not want to find it in Torah. They think that it can't be found in Torah. But Hashem Yisborach says it can be found. Und heute noch, wie wir kennen das gefunden. Zu gehen tanzen inmitten am Mittwoch. Not to have to wait for Simchas Torah. For a dance in the happiness of Torah. That's why I tell you that I'm completely strange to such a concept of diversity in Torah life. But maybe in orthodoxy, there is a place for diversity. Because as I've told you, orthodoxy and Torah is not the same. Those are two worlds. We're living in a world where there are so many things, conservative, reform, reconstructionism and whatnot. So you have an orthodoxy also. In such an orthodoxy, there can be diversity. But in Torah, there is no such thing as diversity. Difference of opinion? Certainly. Beishai understands the depth of the sugya of the Talmud in one manner. Beis Hillel understands it in another manner. The question is, so how must we, who don't understand and have not the seichel either of Beishamai or of Beis Hillel, how are we to engage ourselves in life? For that there is also a Torah of law. Achle rabim lahatois. If the majority opinion is like Beis Hillel, that becomes the aloche. Not because Beis Shammai didn't understand truth. No. The Gemara says on both, Elu v'elu. Divrei Elohim Chaim. Both are the words of the living God. But we have to have a route how to live our lives. In what manner are we to live? Shall we follow Rabbi Yeshua or shall we follow Rabbi Akiva? Shall we follow Reb Lezer or shall we follow those who argue against him? And to such an extent that when such a problem once came up, and Reb Lezer said, Min ha-shamayim yuchichu, heaven will prove that I am right. And heaven proved. And Rabbi Yeshua said, no, he's not right. Lo b'shamayim he. We do not rely on heaven. The Torah says, Achle rabim lahagos. And since the majority says, not like Reb Lezer, but like Rabbi Yeshua, so the halacha is like Rabbi Yeshua. We must follow in his path. Not because what Reb Lezer says is false. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Both of them heard the word of the Almighty God. And it all stems from the giving of Torah at Sinai. That's the way we approach Torah living. And we, Torah Jews, are called fanatics. We are fanatics because we don't want to subserve ourselves to the foolishness of those who think that they can determine what Hashem Yisborach means for us to do. Therefore, we are fanatics. And the greatest of the fanatics in our day, so I read, by the gentleman who will be here next week to speak to you, the greatest of these fanatics is none other than Harav Shach Zalalanglem. Because he fights and battles for Torah. For Torah living. Without any compromises whatsoever. Even if the compromise should be dictated by Shamayim. Lei v'shamayim he. Torah has already taught us how to live. Achli rabim lahatos. And even if heaven says differently, we must follow the dictate of Torah. And this great man, who is not young anymore, and I pray daily that the Almighty keep him with us till the advent of Mashiach Tzidkenu. Because we need him. We need him beyond words. Much more than those who seek adversity in Jewish life. We need him to guide us and lead us. He exudes love to every fellow Jew, even if he's reform or conservative, believe it or not. He exudes love. I have some friends here in the community. You may be surprised. I, the fanatic, have friends in the community who are conservative and reformed Jews. Many times when I hear that they're going to Israel, I call them in. And I ask them, have you ever heard of a place? You've been to Israel many times. Have you ever heard of a place, Bnei Brak? Never heard of it, Rabbi. So I said, I have a place, Bnei Brak, and I have a Jew there that I'd like you to meet. And I'm convinced that when you meet him, you will then think that you have to thank me for the opportunity that I accorded you. And I give them a note to Rav Shach. I tell him, where is Bnei Brak? Don't worry, when you get to Eretz Yisrael, you'll be in Yerushalayim, you'll ask, where's Bnei Brak? And they'll tell you how to get there. It's about 45 minutes from Yerushalayim. And they all do as I ask them. They go into Rav Shach with this note to Rav Shach, written by me in Hebrew. so they don't know what I've written. And I write, Rav Shach, I want you to know that this individual is a wonderful person, but he has not too much in common with you, nor do you have too much in common with him, except the love for a fellow Jew. So I want him to meet you, and I tell them, you have nothing in common with him. Just stand there and look at this individual. And when you come back, you let me know what impression it left upon you. So when they come back, they tell me, Rabbi, I have no words for the opportunity that you offered us to be able to meet this individual. We have no words for it. We have never seen any Jew who exudes love for a fellow Jew as this individual, Rav Shach. When we walked into him, and after reading the note, he takes a cup of pop or whatever it is, and he says, "Trink, du machst abroche." And we can't get away from him. We have to take the drink, and he makes the broche with us. But he has a fruit. Est, u machst abroche. We can't get away. We have to do it. We've never seen such love for a fellow Jew in our life. So then I tell them, but I want you to know, he's the head of the fanatics. No, Rabbi, he's not a fanatic. Far from it. He's overwhelmed with love for every Jew, regardless of what his beliefs are. But if he's a Jew, he loves him. Ben Yisroel, hotanem lib avas nefesh. That I hear from my conservative and reform friends who accept my advice to spend a few moments in Bnei Brak also in order to get an idea. And then I tell them, well, I want you to know, he's the head of the fanatics. I'm one of the fanatics. No, no, Rabbi, it isn't that way. Well, read the New York Times and see what Milton Sapphire writes about us. He has no other word except fanatics. And I know it's due to the fact that he never went to Bnei Brak to look upon Rav Shach. If I could get to him and give him a note, he'd also begin writing different articles in the New York Times. This is the bare truth. There are no diversities in Yiddishkeit. It's either Yiddishkeit or it's not Yiddishkeit. That diversity has been down through the ages because we have freedom of choice. We can live in accordance with Torah, and we're free to decide that we don't want to live in accordance with Torah. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't stop us. He gives us that freedom. But och um weh zu Menschen who wants to make use of that freedom. And now, this gentleman who will be addressing you the coming week, I want to read something to you. How he talks about this individual whom we've just mentioned. During the past year, the Jewish people has been hurt badly by nasty and hurtful words. Listen to that language. Spoken by one group against another and returned in kind. Vicious epithets at each other. And now an elderly sage impugns the honesty and authenticity of one of the truly great religious minds of our generation. He doesn't like the idea that Rav Shach feels that a certain individual in Eretz Yisrael does not understand who the greats of the Bible were. He feels that Rav Shach does not understand the greatness of David HaMelech. Only Adin Steinsaltz understands the greatness of David HaMelech. During the Yom Kippur service, all of us beat our breasts and repent for the sin which we have sinned before for thee. In what? Besinas chinom. In unnecessary hatred. Rav Shach is accused by this individual who will address you the coming week in sinas chinom, unnecessary hatred. Therefore, this is what we must practice if we want to undo the damage that some people are causing in the Jewish world. The damage that Rav Shach is causing in the Jewish world. I must tell you, when I read this article, I became full of remorse. Tzar! Yogin v'anocha! How can an individual who calls himself rabbi, who maintains that he belongs to orthodoxy, how can he speak in such language of this great sage who, as I have told you, is full of love to his fellow man, to say of him that he spreads hatred to Jews? I am determined, therefore, our good friend, your speaker next week, therefore, to love Rabbi Shach. He hates us without reason. So my answer will be, I love him without reason. Shach, now listen to this kind of talk. Rav Shach is not worthy of the title rabbi. But Shach lives in Israel. And he is a sage. And so I will love him. How do you know Haskell Lookstein? How do you know that Rav Shach is a sage? A greiser Talmid Chacham, a godel b'teiru v'yira shamayim. How do you know that he is a sage? What do they want? How do you know that he is a sage? Have you gone through the study of Torah as he has in order to come forth with this judgment that he is a sage? You can't just say any Jew he's a sage because I think so. You must know so. So you yourself must be a boki b'cholatei kule in order to issue such an opinion. Is Haskell such an individual? Did he trouble himself throughout a lifetime in the study of Torah? Why do people from all over the world, not merely religious Jews, bother Rav Shach with questions that do not involve religious problems? Because he's recognized as a sage. And the sage has a cup of the places. He's practically the only one left in our day. So he's bothered from all over the world. And he said recently, because I'm bothered from day until night. So at night when I should be in bed resting, Then I take out a gemara, but I forget myself that I must rest also. So all of a sudden I found it's Alisha Shachar. The sun is already rising. This is Rav Shach, not Shach, but Rav Shach, the Gaon Adir. I call him Avihen Shel Yisroel, the father of Israel. Because anyone who meets him will say, as my conservative friends say, he is full of love, he exudes love to every Jew. When I'm in his presence, I feel I have a father full of love, full of interest in me. Take care of yourself. You need it. You're not well, he tells me. Don't overstrain. Hermeg. But I shouldn't do it. I shouldn't do it. Don't overstrain. And when I told him, that's why I'd like to settle in Eretz Yisrael. No. Don't leave the United States. You must remain there. But take more and longer vacations during the year. And he keeps asking of friends whom I have in Eretz Yisroel and of visitors who come from the Telzer Yeshiva to Eretz Yisroel, is he taking care of himself? This is the Jew who spreads Sinas Chinam. What is there left to say? Only that when I read this article in what newspaper? The Jewish Week, October the 13th. From that day, I am filled with sorrow, with admas nefesh. And why in the world, if you were so wise, why don't you have sense enough to go to Eretz Yisrael and meet this individual? I'm sure you've been in Israel numerous times. Stop over and see him and see if he exudes hatred or he exudes love even to you who writes that he exudes hatred. This is the terrible world in which we live, which is so alien to Torah. It is orthodoxy. That's why I tell you that I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I try to be a Torah Jew. It's not easy. Not at all easy. And I make many mistakes, contrary to what Torah wishes me to do. I'm not a tzaddik, but I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I attempt to be an observant Torah Jew. And that's what I'd like all of you, my friends, to devote your lives to. To feel the joy involved in it. And you will also want to gain a pencil from being a Torah Jew. You will also want to study Torah, to understand its depths. There is no greater joy. Chazal tell us, the sages of the Talmud tell us, Torah is Samar Dechaya, the pill of life. I want you all to enjoy that pill. We live in a world where people are continually taking pills, and I'm among them. And those pills are not pills of life. Tzoras of tzoras. I want you to take this pill, Samadachaya, and begin to feel what indeed is life. Take that pill and you'll begin to feel it. I hope that some of the things which I said here this evening have struck home. I said things which I want every Jew to feel. Every Jew, be he Orthodox, conservative, or Reform, or Reconstructionist, whatever that means. Every Jew should feel the blessings of this pill. And in that manner, my friends, I assure you that you will tell me, Rabbi, he's not a fanatic. He's the greatest lover of Jews that we've ever had occasion to meet. And I wish you also, may you have the occasion to meet him and stand in his presence just to look at him and to enjoy the shine of sanctity which comes forth from him. All be blessed.